Well, Hisham, we met more than 20 years ago, and I'm sure the first day we met, we were probably talking about the two-state solution, which has taken on a life of its own. You know, now that we're writing this book, what, from your perspective as a Palestinian, as a professor, and as an intellectual, how did the two-state solution come to be in the first place? How did we come to call it the solution?
Yes, absolutely, Mark. Yes, indeed. We met over 20 years ago. It's amazing to reflect on those days. And you're absolutely right. I believe from day one we started talking about the quote-unquote two-state solution. And it was proposed as a solution, not even just as an idea. Well, it turned out to be no solution at all. I think that idea dominated in its modern form, so to speak, in the early 1970s as a conversion of interests by the PLO then and the international community. As we may all recall, when the PLO was first launched in 1964 and when it came out in 1965, the prevalent idea in Palestinian discourse, that is, in the PLO and Fatah discourse, especially in Fatah discourse, was that the solution lies in the establishment of a one-state solution, i.e., a democratic, secular state for all Christians, Jews, Muslims, and everybody else, regardless of any religious affiliation. And that continued to be the operative strategy, so to speak, of Fatah during the first few years of its existence. Fatah first managed to achieve one of its first goals, i.e., to attract Palestinians to its ranks, particularly after the Al-Karama battle in 1968, on March 21st, 1968, Fatah managed to attract more Palestinians than it could handle. So, in other words, the domestic rally around Fatah was achieved.
Well, but of course, Hisham, the Arabs and the Palestinians had never agreed to the UN partition plan. They'd never agreed to a Jewish state. They'd always been promised, in fact, up until the mid-40s, that there wasn't going to be a separate Jewish state. So when they came up with the slogan, the idea of a democratic secular state, essentially they were saying, we don't agree to the partition and we should all live happily together. But then there was the 67 war, then there was the occupation, and when was it in Palestinian thinking, and what caused it, that the idea of a little mini-state on the West Bank and Gaza would be acceptable to the Palestinians?
Well, this was what I was really leading up to, but you're absolutely right. That idea of a secular democratic state was indeed an expression of rejecting the partition resolution of 1947. We might come back to this at one point, actually, and talk about, you know, the floating ideas of two states, actually as far back as even 1937 by the British Peel Commission. But, you know, we can come back to that. But, yes, so as Fatah achieved that goal of domestic rally, then it moved on to trying to achieve, you know, Arab regional support and international support. Well, I'm sure, we know that it encountered serious obstacles, particularly in 1970 with the civil war in Jordan and then the expulsion of the PLO to Lebanon. But it was all mainly after the 1973 war, I believe, that the PLO reconciled itself, or at least some elements in the PLO with the dominance of Fatah, reconciled themselves with the idea that they will not be accepted regionally and or internationally until and unless they begin to send signals accepting Israel as a state. Hence, the idea floated around in Palestinian official circles that the PLO would be willing to establish a state on any inch liberated in Palestine. In other words, that signaled acceptance of less than the totality of Palestine for statehood. This came under the proposal of the Palestinian National Authority, ironically.
Well, and interestingly, on the Israeli side and on the Jewish side, with the occupation of 67 came the territories, and in those days, an Israeli who wanted to go to the territories could go, and when they went, they saw refugee camps, and they talked to Palestinians, and they had coffee, and the idea that there are a Palestinian people became something real to Israelis, not to all, of course, but I'm thinking of Lova Eliav, the Secretary General of the Labor Party, who broke with Golda in the early 70s because he spent 6 months going to every city and every camp, and he came back and he said to Golda, we've got to establish a Palestinian homeland for these people. I don't think they used the word state. I think back then it was self-determination. Back then it was homeland. So, and then you had General Peled, and then you had Yehoshaphat Harkabi. There were quite a few top-level Israelis, some in the mainstream of politics, like Lova Eliav, who at the same time that you're describing what Fatah was doing, they were trying to raise these issues within their own circles. They didn't achieve political power. Some of them wrote books, and some of them we remember. But both parties were moving in the direction of mutual recognition. And I think mutual recognition is where the idea of two states came from.
Now, this is very fascinating and interesting, you know, to see how, for argument's sake, I know you might have some reservation on this term, but the maturation of the two-state idea, indeed occurred then. And in Palestinian thought, it was particularly after the Arab recognition of the PLO as the sole legitimate representative of the Palestinian people in Morocco in 1974, and the subsequent recognition of the PLO internationally when Arafat delivered his very famous speech to the United Nations.
And I was in New York at that time. I was finishing law school at NYU when Arafat came. Something you just said about the Arab recognition of the PLO in 74, behind the scenes, I'm guessing, but I'm asking you the question, I'm guessing that part of the deal that was made between the Arab regimes, the client regimes, and the PLO was, okay, we'll recognize you as the sole representative of the Palestinian people. You have got to move in the direction of recognizing Israel because we all want peace in this region. We can't continue with all these wars.
Unquestionably, no. This is not even speculative, Mark. This is in part what happened. That shift in attitude and in position on the part of the PLO, led by, a whole current that is, the accommodationist, so to speak, in the PLO, was encouraged and rather also conditioned by the Arab state system. So you make overtures towards meeting international demands on mainly recognition of Israel. We will extend recognition to you, and we will take off the table the Jordanian attempt by King Hussein to assume representation of the Palestinian people.
Well, Hisham, as we talk with each other, things are coming up in my mind that I hadn't connected the dots for myself. We're talking now about 74. In 75, I had finished both Princeton grad school and NYU law school, And I came to Washington, I think, the end of 75. And very quickly, who did I meet? Because as a result of the things we just talked about, Arafat designated two major PLO persons to come to Washington, Sabri Gerius, an Israeli lawyer, Palestinian lawyer who went to Haifa Law School, and Issam Sertawi, who would later become very famous and very well known. And their goal here was to establish a PLO office, and it was all being done, I now think back and realize because of our conversation, because behind the scenes, everybody was moving at that time in the direction of mutual recognition. They were taking little steps, and then this story to be told in a different chapter, at the last minute, the Americans and the Israelis decided to abort this because just hours before the PLO office was to be announced, Rabin called Kissinger and the FBI went to the hotel that night and they were going to take Sabri and Issam into custody and deport them, even though they'd been here for weeks. And the Egyptian ambassador sent his limo, took them to the embassy, and they were allowed to leave the country without being arrested. But it was at that moment that the Israelis and the Americans said, well, you know, so much for this mutual recognition, you know, we're not planning to go forward with it, so we don't want that office open. Get the hell out of here.
Wow, no, these are amazing details, and I, you know, these are untold details. I know Sabri Gerius, you know, by person. I met him several times. I know all that comfort very well, and I, you know, never had a chance to meet him. But this is unbelievable.
Well, this is one of the purposes of you and I writing together like this, because you lived it from the Palestinian side. I lived it from the Jewish and the Zionist side, in the sense that Nahum Goldman was the man who asked me right out of law school and to go, you know, go to Washington, and you're going to part-time represent the World Jewish Congress. We've never had a representative there. And well, it was in that context that this other thing happened, and I met these people.
What year was that, Mark?
This was 75.
Oh.
And it just happened that was about the time that these other things were happening, and so I was introduced to Sabri and Issam and became good friends with both of them. Later, Sabri invited me to Beirut, where he headed the Institute for Palestine Studies.
Yes.
And as you know, Issam and I became very close friends, and we together achieved the Paris Declaration, the story to be told in detail at some other time.
Right.
And all of this was churning and happening, but you know, you then jump forward to the Brookings Report, which I think was 78, and the Brookings Report set the tone. No, I think it was 76. The Brookings Report set the tone for the Carter administration, and it was one of the first documents that called for Palestinian self-determination, and again, probably something you and I have never discussed. One day I was sitting at the Library of Congress, and I opened the Washington Post, and I started reading the editorial chief's discussion of the Middle East peace process at the time, and it turned out the article was about me, that I had written an article about the Brookings Report for a Jewish publication, and Stephen Rosenfeld was writing that I had hit the nail on the head and that the Brookings Report was going to be very important.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so
this
takes us to the 70s, but if I've got my dates right, all this was happening in these years, but the PLO and the Palestinian community did not endorse formally the idea of a Palestinian state until 1988.
That's definitely true. There were a number of signals given, you know, between the mid-1970s and the 1988 official declaration of statehood that took place in Algiers. But in the interim, I think it is worth noting that the more the clearer the PLO position became on mutual recognition, the more tenacious subsequent Israeli governments became against accepting such overtures by the PLO. In other words, if we think about it, there is an interesting irony of history here. More or less, around the same time, the idea of two states matured in Palestinian political thought. Israel went more and more to the right. The Labor was ousted from office, well, in part, of course, due to the consequences or the results, the unfavorable results of the 1973 war, and also due to some scandal, I think, that surrounded Rabin himself. I believe it was in 1974 or so.
I think it was a few years later. I was here in Washington. His wife had a bank account in, I think, the Riggs Bank, which is now defunct. And it was illegal at the time. There were currency restrictions, and so it was illegal. And that was used to discredit him. And you're right, that helped the revisionist Zionists, Menachem Begin, take power.
Exactly. I mean, you know, so in the face of a maturation of the two-state solution idea in Palestinian discourse, Israel chose, you know, Israeli voters chose, you know, the Likud to come to office, in the process, of course, making it so difficult for the two-state idea to be advanced any further.
Well, there's something else I have to add, and I don't know if we've ever talked about it either. Of course, I can't say this is what happened, but I can tell you what Issam told me. He told me in the early 80s that the Israelis didn't fear Palestinian terrorists. Their army was insuperably stronger. They could take care of that. What they feared was the Palestinian moderates, like himself, which is why he was expelled from Washington. They feared that these were the diplomats who were gaining traction, these were the diplomats who were gaining support all around the world, and that he believed the Israelis were purposefully inciting tension and hatreds within the Palestinian world and using the Abu Nidal movement assassinate the most moderate Palestinians who were precisely calling for the two-state solution. And, of course, the irony is, less than a year after he told me that, he was gunned down representing the PLO at the Socialist International meeting in Lisbon. And that had a tremendous impact on my life, which is another story for another time. But what you're saying is exactly what I was hearing from these people, and we didn't know each other yet, that the Israelis were desperate to get rid of the moderates because they were afraid too much support for a Palestinian homeland was growing.
Absolutely. No, absolutely. The Israelis calculated and accurately so that it would serve their purpose better to have only an exclusive, hardliner Palestinian position, and that it would do them, it would weaken their resolve, and it would change their image to have a group of Palestinian diplomats, a group of Palestinians who are able to travel around the world, speak the language of reason and so on and so forth. And unfortunately, the Palestinians didn't really pay much attention, I believe, to the Israeli role, multiple role, I believe. Number one, in deepening rift among Palestinians, exactly as you said, using some Palestinian, center groups. I mean, the Abu Nidal group, almost every act it performed, it was in counter-distinction to Palestinian interests, either assassinating Palestinians or, attacking some Israeli, making attacks on some Israeli targets, basically to provoke the Israelis against the Palestinians.
We also have to add that after 67, the Israelis had another plan. They had the Alone plan. They had the idea of autonomy. They wanted to find Quisling groups. They called them village leagues. They were going to have the election for the village leagues. They were desperately trying to build up some sort of local Palestinian groups that they could work with and outflank the PLO.
Oh, absolutely. No, absolutely. I mean, the Alone plan, and then it was carried over, you know, by the Likud government. I was in Palestine exactly there at the time when the village league idea was injected in the early 1980s, in 1981. And the Israelis appointed a professor of Arabic language at Hebrew University, Menachem Nilsson, to head the autonomy administration for Palestinians, and one of the first projects he came up with was to establish an alternative representative to the PLO from among Palestinians in the occupied territories under the name of the Bridge League.
Exactly, and what you may not know, because it was happening in my life and in the Jewish world, the hatred for the PLO and the attempt to enforce that the PLO cannot be dealt with, cannot be talked to. When I was meeting with the PLO people, a close friend of mine who had been the director of admissions at the Princeton Graduate School, in fact, and who headed up a Jewish think tank, a liberal, reasonable, very well-educated person, he showed me a memo that had been written by AIPAC about me, that I was helping the PLO and that I should be shunned. And then he told me, in fact, Mark, if you are going to have any contact with the PLO, you can't any longer be associated with me and my institute. I was absolutely shocked.
Wow.
And then just a few years later, when the Paris Declaration was published, again, this story will be told in more detail, there it was on the front page of Le Monde, the entire front page of Le Monde, signed by the man who founded the World Jewish Congress and founded the World Zionist Organization, signed by the former president of France, signed by Philip Klutznik, the leading Jewish personality in America at the time. And those three people were told by the leadership of the World Jewish Congress, even though they had founded it and been its president, that their statement, because it talked about the PLO and because it talked about a Palestinian homeland, they were going to be disassociated from their own organization, and their own organization was going to disassociate itself from them.
For a few moments, actually, the quality of the voice went down for some reason. I don't know.
Just continue. Go ahead.
Absolutely. I mean, it would be fascinating if you could come up with this memo by AIPAC. That'll be great to have it.
Well, it'll come from memory. But, okay, so here we are then in the 80s. The Israelis are not only undermining the idea of a Palestinian state after toying with it, the PLO is desperately trying to stay on top of things, and at the time was being hosted around the world. Jews were being told to even associate with them means you're going to be disassociated from your Jewish community. Israelis, I remember, were arrested. If Israelis went off and had meetings in Europe or America with anybody in the PLO, when they got home to Israel, they were arrested.
Oh, the crackdown on the PLO was absolutely, absolutely real, and on any contact with the PLO was absolutely, absolutely real. As I said, you know, this Nilsson guy, he worked very, very hard to gather a bunch of Palestinian collaborators, okay? And he tried to empower them and tried to convince them that they will have the upper hand. But his attempt failed. He also, did a number of other measures to weaken and actually destroy the PLO base of support in the occupied territories. I remember vividly back in 1981, I was a student at Beirut University, freshman. And after, literally after a couple of weeks from the start of the semester, on the 2nd of November 1981, the university was shut down for 2 months. And then after it was opened by a few days, it was closed again in 1982 for 2 more months, and then for 3 more months, so 7 months in one academic year, because Birzeit was considered at that time to be one of the main bases of support for the PLO. My point here is that Nilsson failed. Once he sent one of his assistants to Birzeit, Gabay, Simon Gabay, I think his first name is Simon, but I can't verify that, but his last name is Gabay for sure. And the idea of sending Gabay to Birzeit was a double-fold. Number one, to make it look like that the administration then of Birzeit was collaborating with the Israelis, which was not the case at all. There was a very decent man leading the university, Dr. Gabi Baranki. But the second objective was to impose on the PLO, on Birzeit, as well as on other academic institutions or institutions of higher education in Palestine, to impose on them what was called the law of higher education prepared by the Israelis, law number 854. But when Gabay arrived at the university, the students and the student council got a note of that and went to the offices of the administration where he was trying to create the image that he was, you know, pursuing collaborative relations with the administration, and grabbed him and basically threw him off the stairs. I mean, it was a big, big event. I remember that very well.
Right, and just like you were having those experiences, I was having my experiences in the U.S. and Europe and with the Jewish organizations. You know, interesting, we haven't even mentioned Camp David of 1978, which was supposed to be an attempt to bring about a solution. And then, jumping 1 year ahead, the Israelis behind the scenes were planning the invasion of Lebanon, and the goal of the invasion of Lebanon, if I understand it right, one, they wanted to turn Lebanon into a vassal client of Israel, and two, they wanted to destroy the PLO once and for all.
Absolutely. So, you know, the Gabay story took place in 82, and immediately thereafter, after the failure of cracking down on Palestinians in the occupied territories, although, I mean, they really caused a lot of pain. I was there. I mean, so many arrests, you know, so many curfews, so many closures of universities. They turned, okay, to delve a blow to the PLO in the process to destroy, you know, the idea of accommodation, to destroy the idea of peace overtures by the PLO, not just to destroy the PLO as an infrastructure or as an institution. No. Sharon wanted to wipe out the infrastructure, but he also wanted to really eliminate this rising and growing Palestinian presence on the international scene. That's, I think, what he wanted.
And he certainly did not envision the exile to Tunis, but the Americans insisted on that. And I suspect Sharon and the Israelis thought at the time, okay, you know, we weren't able to kill them all. We destroyed their infrastructure. We got rid of them. We took their institutes and their libraries, and we raped everything. But I suspect they didn't believe the PLO would really reconstitute itself in Tunis. And then, jumping ahead, because we'll deal with the details when we can, the PLO reconstituted itself and moved forward to the 1988 seminal meeting, which was, for you Palestinians, where were you at the time, and when you heard what was happening at the PNC meeting, what did you think?
Well, you know, I was in the States. I was actually in California. I was still a graduate student at UC Santa Barbara, finishing, you know, my PhD.
Right.
Well, just the year before, you know, the Palestinian Intifada broke out, basically signifying Palestinian despair, with the Arab political system, with the international community. I mean, after the PLO was expelled from Tunis, the PLO was weakened. It wasn't just, you know, finished off, but it was weakened. Its ability to cater for some Palestinian needs and, you know, demands in the occupied territories was also considerably weakened. Palestinians in the occupied territories felt that they were somewhat left alone. The Arab political summit in Amman, Jordan, in November 1987, did not hardly mentioned the Palestinian question, you know, by name, and it was only at the very end of its statement in a marginal way. Unlike the lip service they used to pay for the Palestinian cause before.
And all of that contributed to the Palestinian eruption.
Exactly, exactly, in addition to other reasons. So, you know, the killing of several Palestinians in the Gaza, several Palestinian workers. So in December 1987, the Intifada broke out, and I think that PLO found in that opportune moment to reassert, you know, themselves and their presence and their involvement. Abu Jihad, the second man in the PLO at the time, was actively involved in trying to coordinate, you know, Intifada activities, although everybody knows that the Intifada broke out by the people in the occupied territories without any PLO control, without any official control from anybody.
Okay.
For movement.
And then the Israelis, realizing what was going on, they did the Tunis operation and killed Abu Jihad.
Exactly.
And exactly. Was that, did that assassination take place before the 1988 Algiers PNC?
Yes, it did. And it was a big event, really, for Palestinians, because Abu Jihad was widely respected. He was widely considered as an honest, decent, very devoted man.
I think it was Barak himself who commanded that operation.
That's the
current defense minister.
Yes, indeed. That was really the story, I mean, that everybody basically believed. So,
all right, then comes 88, and the Palestinians take the official step of declaring. In fact, if I've got it right, I kind of remember Yasser Arafat started calling himself the president of Palestine in 88.
That's true. So, you know, on November 15, 1988, the Algiers declaration of, you know, independence. Well, how did I feel about it when I, you know, knew
mm-hmm.
about it?
Mm-hmm.
I had multiple feelings. Number one, it was an emotional moment. I wasn't there, but, you know, I heard some of the speeches and I kept up with what's going on. It was an emotional moment, but at the same time, I felt that it was more symbolic than real. I felt that the occupation is still entrenched and that it was good, yes, to make this political move, but the question is, how would you concretize it? So that was, I think, a watershed moment in my life, you know, politically speaking. I felt that, you know, symbolism and reality were at odds, quite frankly, Mark, that the PLO was trying to meet international demands more so than to deal with development and realities on the ground.
Well, then, to complete the overview that we're looking at, a few years later comes Saddam's invasion of Kuwait. That's quite a story in itself, and what most Americans have been told about what happened then, I don't think is even close to what really happened. Then that's followed by the Madrid Conference in 1991, and if I remember right, at the Madrid Conference, even though there was Dr. Abdel Shafi heading the Palestinian delegation, the Israelis would not let the Palestinian delegation sit as Palestine. They insisted it be part of the Jordanian delegation.
That's correct.
Well, and the Palestinians accepted.
That's true. It was the joint Jordanian-Palestinian delegation, which, of course, threw some more doubt you know, in my mind, on the nature of these moves and, you know, overtures.
Well, that would have had to cause you to further underscore what you said, because here they had declared a state. Arafat's supposed to be the president of the state, and yet when the international conference takes place, they don't even get to sit as Palestine.
Absolutely. I mean, well, candidly, I think, you know, the main point that threw me off, or one of the main points, was immediately after that Algiers declaration, as you may recall, it was the Reagan administration. It lifted the ban on contacts with the PLO. And the U.S. ambassador in Tunis, started some, you know, contact, some talk with some PLO representatives. And the PLO representative in Tunis at the time was a guy with the name of Hakam Belaoui. Hakam Belaoui, I have to say, is not respected by many Palestinians. He is considered to be an opportunist and self-serving and interested only in his own.
Okay, we had Hassan Rahman here, so I know what you're talking about.
So, I mean, that's even a topic in itself. That's a chapter in itself. So, I mean, you know, that these moves towards the international community and some of the Palestinians placed in these key positions was really questionable from the vantage point of many Palestinians, like, you know, Rahman and Belaoui, and, you know, we definitely don't want to be sued by these individuals personally, but the fact of the matter is that these were political figures, and they are absolutely despised by Palestinians all over the world for their performance.
Look, I was living here in Washington, and me and my Palestinian friends, number one, we laughed about Hassan, and number two, we never wanted to invite him to anything or to be part of it, even though, of course, we were all strongly supportive of Palestinian rights. But we considered him an uncouth type, a corrupt type, and a stupid type, and I remember in those days, Edward Said was saying that every time he sees Arafat, he pleads with Arafat to replace Hassan Rahman.
Yes, and the unfortunate thing is, you know, this was the case in most capitals of the world, not in all of them, but most of the people most of the Palestinians who were placed in these offices were not qualified and were not the best.
But Hisham, I think the overreaching point we should make, let's see if we agree on it, is in those days, which is, there were settlers, but nothing like today. There was no wall. The bypass roads and the apartheid regulations were just beginning. In those days, we all still thought, didn't we, that if we could get the Israelis to change their policy, or if the Americans would put their foot down, there could be a two-state solution. We were all still hoping and pushing and imagining and thinking it's still possible, or were you already despondent about it?
Well, I mean, I can't write a whole chapter on that one.
You're going to, but right now I want the summary.
No, absolutely. You know, there was some hope, okay, and there was some desire, and there was some need by people, okay, for the two-state idea to work on. Personally, I advocated the two-state solution because I do consider myself to be a pragmatist and, you know, in line with the international community. But deep inside, for some reason, I did have a profound subconscious feeling, which I need to further investigate myself, that idea would not work. Now I understand more why. I need to do more thinking.
Well, it sounds like partly because, either maybe unconsciously, you didn't really trust the leadership that was speaking in your name.
I trusted Arafat, but I did not trust many others around him. Mm-hmm. And I knew that they were really self-serving, that they were not genuine, and that they were mediocre.
And that brings us to 93, where, you know, we skipped the years of negotiations where Abdul Shafi was leading a dignified negotiating team. Then all of a sudden this Oslo thing comes along, and immediately people like you and me looked at it and said, and as you know, because I have told you a number of times, on that day I wasn't on the White House lawn. I was doing the live commentary for CBC television throughout the ceremony.
Right.
And I was saying right then, this doesn't seem to me a marriage that's going to work. It's being hyped, and we're being assured that this is real peace. But, and you know, I gave my reasons at the time, and we now know that Abdul Shafi refused to even go to the ceremony. And where were you when that took place?
Well, very good question. I was sitting watching TV at my family's house in Dehesha.
And what was the atmosphere there?
The atmosphere there was one of disbelief, one of disbelief. You know, this period was accompanied, I mean, you know, this event, more or less, was accompanied by some measures, okay, in the occupied territories by some Palestinians, which disturbed most Palestinians. And let me clarify that. I mean, there were some Palestinian personalities which were trying to be active during, you know, the Madrid talks, during the negotiations throughout this period. Who were trying to send signals to the Israelis that they are serious. One of them was Sarin Saber, who is the president of the Al-Quds University right now. And Sarin Saber, in an attempt to, I guess, prove, quote-unquote, to the Israelis that he is reasonable, you know, he organized, I think, a march, a small march, because not too many people would join him, and started showering Israeli soldiers on their jeeps, you know, with olive branches and with, you know, flowers. And, you know, started trying acts of jumping on the jeeps and so on and so forth. So Palestinians instinctively knew that those moves, okay, were more harmful than good to them, not because they don't want peace, no, but simply because they did not trust many of the people who were involved in the...
Well, the top person who was involved, Arafat, was the figurehead, but Abu Mazen was the man behind
absolutely.
The scenes pulling all the strings and signing the documents, wasn't he?
Absolutely, absolutely. And that was definitely one of the reasons. I remember my own feelings then, okay? You know, my own feelings then. I said I was at my family's house, and I knew I didn't have, you know, really all of the explanations or even most of the explanations. I cannot say what I did, but I knew right then that we as Palestinians were entering into a whole new phase, the parameters and the contours of which were completely unknown to me. For some reason, I had very, very heavy feelings then.
Well, if I hear what you're saying, while the rest of the world was applauding, while people were being told there's going to be a Palestinian state, and I had interviewed Boutros Ghali after Camp David in 79, and he promised me in heated language there would be a Palestinian state in a year. I should come back and see him and apologize to him for being so negative, he told me. So that was 79. Now it's 93. The world was looking at this and saying, oh my goodness, there's finally going to be peace, and there's this five-year peace process. And Arafat looked as if he believed it, but
right.
You're telling me that in your circles, there was despair and anxiety, and it almost sounds as if, from your point of view, this wasn't the birth of, this wasn't the fulfillment of the two-state solution. It was the beginning of your realizing that the two-state solution had become dangerous for the Palestinians.
Well, you know, that was September okay, September 13, and of course it was a celebratory mood all over the world, but particularly, you know, in the United States, and more specifically, you know, in Washington, D.C., in the White House. But, you see, just not long before, I was in the States. I left the States to Palestine in early June, 93. So I was in Palestine for about 3 months then. And as I was, you know, observing how Israeli measures against Palestinians were getting tighter and worse by the day, even through the signing of the Oslo or the Declaration of Principles, you know, in the White House garden. So